Okay. So, quick reminder of where we were. We started talking about I/O devices. Okay, so two pictures to keep in mind: the hardware layout of what your machine's I/O subsystem looks like. There's basically a bus that is connected to I/O peripherals. It's a PCI bus in most cases for PCs. And basically this is a shared medium and it connects to various I/O devices. Each device has a controller, okay, that is responsible for interacting with the device, and there is a device itself. So for the monitor there is a graphics card or a graphics controller and a monitor. For a disk there is a disk controller and it will be connected to multiple disks and so on. That's the hardware layout to keep in mind. This is what the OS I/O subsystem looks like. Okay. So for each, so this is the hardware thing that I showed you in the previous slide. There's devices and there are controllers for those devices, and this is where the boundary of the OS lies. Okay, this is the hardware software boundary. So the lowest levels or lowest layer of your operating systems are all device drivers. Okay, there's one device driver for each device. That device driver has all of the hardware knowledge it needs to communicate with the controller or communicate with the device through the device controller. Okay, that's the picture to keep in mind. We started talking about different types of devices, different types of I/O, the fact that you can use polling to do I/O, you can use interrupts to do I/O, you can use direct memory access or DMA, which is what modern I/O devices use. Okay, so we'll continue from that point on. So remember, we were talking about block devices and character devices towards the very end of the class. The main difference between the two is what is the granularity of I/O. Okay? As the name suggests, in character devices, you basically read or write in granularity of individual characters, one byte at a time. Okay? Let's assume characters are bytes. Okay? In block devices, you read and write in granularity of blocks. Okay? Blocks are maybe 1K, 4K, some chunk of data. Okay? So disks are good examples of block devices. Okay, things like keyboards are good example of character devices. You read a key press, that's essentially will generate one or a few bytes. Okay, so there's a difference between the two. Okay, other difference is whenever you have block devices, okay, you need buffering at the I/O end to deal with mismatches. Okay, and that's what we are going to talk about. Character devices typically do not include a buffer between the OS and the device itself. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why you need buffering, what it means. Okay, so most I/O devices will have a small onboard memory, okay, where they can temporarily store data. Okay, so that's basically the I/O buffer. So for instance, every disk that you have comes with some onboard cache and or buffer. Okay, so anytime whenever it reads from the disk head, okay, so remember that I had showed you this picture where you had this disk platter, there were tracks, there's a disk head, okay? And the disk is spinning. As the disk is actually reading or from this, what the data that it read actually goes into a disk buffer, okay, which is on the device itself. This is memory that is on the device. Okay? And then later on, once the I/O is complete, the disk buffer is then, the data from the disk buffer is transferred to the operating system RAM, okay, using DMA. Okay, so this is typically what happens. So whenever you have block I/O, you have this buffer that is sitting in between the device and the RAM or the OS buffer cache. Okay, so typically you store the block when it's read from disk, it's transferred over the bus by DMA into a physical RAM. Okay, and then once it's done, then the DMA controller will interrupt the CPU. Okay, this is not necessary if you have character, you're reading or writing individual bytes, because that's very slow device. You can just read it and send it directly to the OS buffer cache. Whenever you have faster devices, it's better to have a buffer where you read and write. And the same is true when you're writing out data. If you're writing to the disk, what you do is you take the block you want to write from the RAM, put it into the disk buffer. Okay? And then you basically ask the disk to write it to a certain location. And what happens is basically the disk head will move to that location, you'll incur some rotational latency, and then you just take data from the disk buffer and write it out, okay, to the device itself. So buffering is part of all I/O devices, is something to keep in mind. And there's a question of how does this buffer help? The most important reason why you need a buffer is there's a mismatch between the speed of the CPU and the speed of the device. Okay? So the rate at which the CPU can read and write data to RAM is different from the rate at which a device such as a disk can read and write data. Okay? So if there was no buffer, if the CPU was actually sending data at full speed to the disk, there is no way the disk can actually sustain that throughput and write it down. So this is basically the intermediate storage where the data comes from the OS and then the disk writes it out, or you read from the disk and then you transfer that data to the operating system. Okay? So that's basically the key reason why you need I/O buffering. There's another example here which is basically the display of a buffer and then displaying, writing some pixels to a buffer on the graphics card and then having the graphics card display it out. Okay, so making the pixels visible on a screen is fast, but reading or writing data from RAM to this buffer is relatively slower, so you need again to deal with that mismatch. Okay? The other reason is having this buffer helps you cope with different transfer sizes. Okay? The one thing that I have not mentioned in this picture is the disk is reading or writing in granularity of sectors. Okay? Sectors could be 512 bytes, 732 bytes as we saw two or three classes back. What OS is writing is in terms of file system blocks. Okay? File system blocks could be 1 or 4K at a time. Okay? That's the granularity that the file system is reading and writing to disk. The disk itself has a different granularity of reads and writes, which is sector. Okay? So to deal with this mismatch, you store the data here, then you can chop it up into sectors and write it out, or read multiple sectors, construct a block and send that back to the OS. Okay? So all of that happens on the OS side. And then the last but not least, writing it out to the disk buffer also reduces the time you have to wait if you are doing a blocking call. Okay? If you are writing some data out to disk, in this again continuing this example, all you have to do is transfer this to the I/O buffer. Okay? And then you can assume that the write has completed. You don't have to actually wait for the disk to write this out to the device. Okay? So that basically speeds up the time that you have to block on a synchronous write call. Okay? And then this buffer also serves as a cache. Okay? So the other advantage is typically what you can do is you can use the buffer to not only use it as a staging area for reads or writes, you can also use it as a cache. These buffers could be of few megabytes in size. Okay? So recently read or written data could be stored in the cache. If you get another request, you could actually go ahead and service it from the cache. Okay? You can do read ahead at the disk level. Okay? So if you are on a particular track, the request was to only read one sector, you can anyway go ahead and read the other sectors and store them in the cache. Just in case future requests try to access those sectors, you already are positioned where you need to be. So why not read a little extra data and store it in the cache? Okay? So all of these optimizations actually help you improve performance. Okay. So there are examples here saying so what would happen then is whenever you do a read, you'll first look in the cache. If it's already in the cache, then you'll return it from there. Otherwise, you'll actually go read it from disk. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. So one last point here is whenever you have a cache of any sort, okay, you probably have heard of these terms. You can use either a write-through policy or a write-back policy for the cache. Okay, and there is a trade-off here between performance and reliability. Okay? First question is, have people heard of write-through, write-back policies in 201? Sorry? No, I'm just asking. I will explain what they are. I'm saying, have you heard of these terms? Is this? No. Okay. So let me explain what this means. So there is two. So there are two standard policies. It doesn't matter where, what kind of cache we are talking about. Okay, this could be a processor cache on the CPU. This could be a cache on the disk. Not important. Okay, what is important is what happens at the cache when you try to do a write to something. Okay, so let's take the disk as an example. So there are two policies, write through and write back. what write through says is, if you are going to update a piece of data, let's say it's a block, okay, and this block is in the cache, then not only do you update in the cache, you propagate that update to the device itself. Okay, so let's say you are the OS. So if you're doing a write of a block, you go and update that data item in the cache. Okay? And if you're doing write through, that write actually propagates all the way to the device. Okay? So that's what write through means. Okay? What write back means is basically whenever you do a write, just update it in the cache and return. Okay? And at a later time, the dirtied block in the cache is written out to disk. Okay? So if you delay the writing from the cache to the disk, that's called write back. Okay? If you actually require that the write go hit the cache, update the block in the cache, and then have that block be flushed to the device, that's called write through. Okay? So these are what the terms mean. Okay? This is independent of I/O devices. These are just for any cache, you have to define when you have a cache. Are you going to do write back or write through whenever some updates come in? Okay, now let's talk. Is that clear what I said? Okay, now let's talk about what this has got to do with I/O devices. Okay, so depending on which policy you use, okay, you get a trade-off between performance and reliability. Okay, the claim is a write through performance has a higher reliability, a write back or a write-through policy has higher reliability, a write-back policy has better performance. Okay, so let's now assume that you have a disk that's spinning. Okay, you have a cache here, and then writes are coming in. Okay, let's say you're doing write-back. Okay, the claim is this is going to yield better performance. The reason for that is all the writes just hit the cache and then you return. Okay, so if you are doing a blocking I/O call, you only wait until the data you are trying to write is actually returned to the cache, okay, rather than to the device. And as soon as it's returned to the cache, you will return and the process will continue execution. Okay, this should be clear that that's faster. Okay, if you are doing write through, on the other hand. No, these seem to work. Okay. So writes come in, you go update the blocks in memory, then you wait until those blocks are actually written out to disk. Okay. And the process that initiated the write is going to have to block until the data actually gets written out to disk. Okay. This is going to be slower because you have to wait until this slow I/O device has completed the write. Okay, to the device itself. Okay? But it has better reliability. The question is, why does it have better reliability? Yeah. Right, but how does it improve reliability of the system? What you're saying is absolutely right, but how does that observation translate to? Yeah, something.
Trying to retrieve that data, it might have been not updated on the cache yet.
Okay, so if you retrieve the data, actually retrievals are not the problem, because when you retrieve, you always check in the cache. See that? You always first check. If you don't go to the disk, if it's already in the cache, so you will actually retrieve the more up-to-date version. If you blindly went and retrieved the old version from the disk, that's a problem. But if you always check here before you go there, it's not a problem. Yes. Right. So if you lose power, so suppose that you are doing write back. Okay, so you gone and updated some disk. Let's say it's a file system. Right. You wrote to some file. Okay. Only thing that has happened, so you assume that the write is complete because you wrote the write return Only thing that has happened in write back is that the data you wrote is sitting in the cache here, in the OS buffer cache. Okay, and your write has returned. So you assume that the write has finished, but the write has actually not propagated to the disk. It's still sitting in memory here. Okay. Now if you lose power, okay, this is volatile memory, right? So all your writes will disappear. So if you power cycle your machine, the writes that you assumed are done will not actually be reflected on what's on disk. You'll see either an old version of the file or something like that. Okay. On the other hand, if you do write through, every write actually hits the disk, which means you know that the data on disk has been updated. Okay. This is the safer thing to do from a reliability perspective. Even if you lose power, all the writes that have completed, or that the OS claims have completed, have actually gone to disk. So if you power cycle, the data is still on disk, as you expect it to be. Okay. But this is going to be slower, significantly slower, because you are waiting to do a complete, for the completion of a slow I/O operation. Okay, which can take milliseconds or tens of milliseconds. Okay. Writing to memory is orders of microseconds, okay, or even nanoseconds or fast memory. So then you have a question, do you want to play safe or do you want better performance? You can't have both. Okay, if you turn on write back policy, you will get good performance. All the writes will seem to be very fast because you're just writing to memory. Okay, the OS pretends as if the write has gone to disk, okay, but it hasn't. So you get very good write performance, but if you lose power, then all of those writes that haven't yet been flushed, to all the dirty blocks or the dirty pages that haven't been flushed to your disk are all gone. Okay, so you have made a performance reliability trade-off. So if you want to play safe, you use write through, but then every write is going to be slow. You'll wait, have to block for tens of milliseconds for the write to complete. So for any disk subsystem or any place there is a cache, you actually have this choice. Okay, so typically either the device driver or the file system code, you can set a flag saying you want to do write through or write back. Okay, so you may get better performance, but worse reliability, or better reliability, but worse performance. Okay. This is a choice you have to make. You can actually, in some cases, some operating systems allow you to toggle this bit. Because it's up to the user whether they care more about performance or reliability. If you believe that you don't lose power a whole lot, okay? Or if you have a laptop which has a battery, so it's not running on power all the time, it's running on battery, it may be okay. Yeah, of course, if you lose battery power, your battery goes to zero, you lose data. That's a different problem. Okay? So this is a choice that any user has to make. The OS actually provides typically both of those features. The administrator or the user of a machine has to pick the right thing. So that's basically what this caching thing is. Any questions on this? Okay, as I said, this is not only for I/O devices or I/O caches. It's write through or write back policy. It's true for any cache. It's true even for a processor level cache. Okay, so in typically processor level caches, for safety, you typically do write through. Okay, if you update some data, okay, if you do store, for instance, the store doesn't just hit the processor's L1 or L2 cache and return, it actually propagates that all the way to RAM. And that's important because if there are multiple cores, if you only update your local cache, some other core tries to access the same data item, you haven't propagated it to memory, then you will actually have inconsistencies. You wrote to a variable, the value of the variable hasn't been reflected in RAM, it's still sitting in the, let's say, the L2 cache. And some other thread running on other core reads it, you get an old data. Okay, so typically processors will do write through, yeah, to prevent these problems, consistency problems. In I/O devices you have this choice, because I/O devices are very slow, you can use either one. Okay, if you care about performance, you can do write back. Okay, so just, this is the big picture, okay, of what happened during an I/O call. So all of the pieces that we have sort of explained here. So the I/O request has to come from a process. Okay? So user process request, let's say a read or a write. Okay? Let's assume it's a read. So if it's a read, the OS is first going to check the OS buffer cache. Is the data that's requested already in the buffer? If so, you have a cache hit and you're done. Okay? So you just read from the buffer and service that I/O request. There's no reason to do actual I/O. Okay? Now if you have a cache miss, which means the data that's requested is not in the buffer, okay, then you go to the device driver saying go and actually initiate a read operation. Okay. Device driver then tells the DMA controller saying here is a buffer, okay, go read this chunk of data from the device, put it into this RAM buffer. Okay, DMA it into the RAM buffer. Okay. And then the process is blocked, okay, because it's waiting on IO. The OS can do something else. Okay, it can execute some other process. While some other processes are executing on your processor, okay, the DMA controller, okay, actually has the device do the IO. It take the data from this, from the device cache, okay, and then it does a DMA into the RAM location that is specified. That's this step. Okay. Controller transfers the data from to the kernel buffer. Okay, when it's been retrieved from the device, this step is actually multiple step. The DMA controller has to interact with the device and actually get the data. It takes the data and puts it into RAM. Okay. Once this is done, then you raise an interrupt saying the operation is complete, the data is in the buffer that was specified. Okay. Once that is done, okay, the data is still in the kernel buffer, it's not yet in the application buffer. So the OS then actually transfers the data from the kernel buffer to an application buffer. Okay, when you say read, you specify a buffer. Okay. So then the OS is going to transfer it into that buffer that you specified in the read call. Okay. Once that is done, then the process can unblock. Okay, it was waiting for the IO operation to complete. Now at this point it's complete, so you go back in the ready queue. Okay, and then you can execute the process at some later time. Okay. So these are all the steps that actually happen in the operating systems when you initiate an IO request. Okay, so lots of pieces. So there's a picture here that shows you all of the same steps. Okay, so you start with the read call. Okay, you specify this is the buffer that it needs to be read to. That's your RAM buffer. And then you go to the DMA controller saying go and initiate this request. CPU can then start executing something else. Okay, DMA controller interacts with the disk controller saying go read this thing. Okay, and then once you have it, then tell me, and then the DMA controller will take it from the disk buffer and then transfer, which is called DMA read, into this buffer. Okay. Once it's in that buffer, then you will raise an interrupt saying it's done. That's the typically this buffer is a kernel buffer, not an application specified buffer. So once the OS has the data in this buffer, it will copy it here from the application into the application's address space. Okay. So lots of copies happen, lots of hardware pieces are involved here in a typical IO call. Any questions on this? Okay. So that's basically all we have for an IO. Okay, so this is basically a checkpoint on where we are. Okay, so we have done processes and thread synchronization. So that component was one. We did memory management, okay, which I'll review again later today. And we have finished the third component, which is file systems, IO devices, scheduling, and so on. Okay, so three of the four key components of the course are done. Okay, the last one is distributed systems. Okay, so this is where we will now look at how do you go from one machine to multiple machines. Thus far, everything we have looked at only deals with a single machine, the processor on a machine, the memory on a machine, IO devices on a machine. The part we did not look at is the network. Okay, so most of your machines have a network card. It could be a Wi-Fi card or an Ethernet card. Okay, you use this interface to interact with other machines. Okay, so that basically is the last component of the course, which is distributed systems. So I'm going to start with a brief review of networking. Okay, maybe if you're taken 453 or are taking it with 377, you probably know all of this. Okay, but for those of you who haven't taken it, this is necessary background to actually discuss the remainder of that component. Okay, so we'll do networking basics today. Next time I'm going to talk about remote procedure calls. Next time being a week from today, because Thursday's class is a guest lecture. Okay, so we'll do remote procedure calls and we'll do distributed file systems. Okay, so that's basically and some components of distributed operating systems. Okay, so that's basically the next few classes. So let's start with what is a distributed system. Okay, well, let's define a distributed system and then we'll look at networking, okay, as a sort of the component of. So this is a picture, a generic picture of a distributed system. The definition is basically it's a set of physical processors that communicate with one another using a communication medium. Okay. So distributed system has multiple processors. Okay. It has a communication medium which is referred to as a network. Okay. And processes or applications running on these processors can communicate with one another over a network. Okay. That will be our definition of a distributed system. Okay. Now the thing to realize is practically every system you use today, every application you use today is distributed in some shape or form. Okay. Web is an example of a global scale distributed system. Okay. Your browse. In the context of a web, some processes or some machines are running clients, namely browsers. Some processors or machines are running servers. Okay, web servers, applications of various sorts, and you communicate. In this case, the network is the internet. Yeah, that's an example of a wide area application. If you are doing email, that's an example of another distributed system. You have mail clients, which could be a browser or any client that you use, and your email is actually stored on some other server. Okay? So, mail client and the mail server communicate. In this case, it's probably over a LAN, a local area network. If you do network printing, that's an example of another distributed system. Okay, in this case, the processor may be your machine that's trying to print a job. Okay, the other processor could be the processor inside a printer, in the network printer, that runs a network print server. Okay, so your machine is actually printing jobs to a network print server. Okay, and so on and so forth. File servers are examples of distributed systems where some machines store files, they are servers, and other machines are clients that access files remotely. Okay, so practically every thing that you see in modern environments, okay, end up as some distributed examples of distributed system. Okay, so file servers, email, network printers, remote backup, web, all web applications that come with it. Okay, so these are where, so what we'll do is some very fundamental things that tell us how to construct distributed system. Okay. If you are interested in this, there's a graduate level course, 677, which I also teach, where you go into this in a lot more detail. It's a semester long course on distributed system that picks up from where we leave off in 377. Okay, but as far as this course is concerned, this is just going to be a 3-4 lecture introduction to distributed systems. Okay. So now we'll distinguish between tightly coupled distributed systems, which are also sometimes called parallel systems, and loosely coupled distributed systems, which is referred to also distributed computing. Okay. So the difference between the two just depends on how tightly connected are these processors. In both cases, you have multiple processors as a communication medium. Depending on how tightly coupled they are, you may either get a parallel processing system or a loosely coupled distributed computing based system. Okay. In tightly coupled system, typically processors share a clock, memory, and may run more than one OS, but not necessarily. Okay. So the important thing is the coupling is tight, meaning that there is a clock that you share typically. Okay. You may even share memory. Okay. So do you know of any examples of tightly coupled systems? Yeah.
A video card.
Okay. So you have a processor there that shares the clock. Other examples? Yeah.
You have VMware.
VMware, yeah, that's actually virtualization, which we will come back to next time. Any other thoughts? Yes. Okay, dual core machine. So practically everything you buy today, because you have multiple cores, end up as the former. Okay, until recently you had only one processor on the machine, so that was a uniprocessor system. Today every machine at least has two cores. Okay. Even smartphones have started having two cores. Okay. So that's an example of a tightly coupled system according to our definition. Okay. Multiple processors, communication medium is a system bus. Okay. The network in this case just happens to be the system bus, and there's a tight coupling, okay, because you share memory and so on. Okay. So most modern machines actually look like this. They have already become distributed. Now, loosely coupled distributed system basically says each processor has its own memory. Okay, that's not shared with other processors. Each processor runs its own independent OS. And that's basically any client-server type environment, any environment where you have a large cluster of machines where each machine is independent, just have a high-speed local area network that allows communication between these machines. Okay? Or you can just have a global scale system where machines are just spread across the internet. Okay? So all of those are examples of distributed system. The big difference here is communication here is much cheaper than communication here. Okay? Because in this case, in the tightly coupled case, communication just means you send a message over the system bus. Okay? That's fairly inexpensive. In this case, you actually send a message over a real network. Okay? It could be a Wi-Fi network, a LAN, or a WAN. Okay? So communication is expensive and hence should be less frequent because it's an expensive operation. In tightly coupled system, it doesn't have to be. You can have frequent communication. Okay, so now let's ask the question, why have systems that are distributed? Okay, what are some advantages? Okay, so there are several. First one is resource sharing. Okay, fundamentally what your distributed system allows you to do is the ability to access resources on remote machines, remote processors, okay, from a machine. Okay, so the web is a good example. You actually access content that's stored on some other machine. Okay. So that machine is able to share its content across a large number of users. Okay? File server is another example. You can actually share the disk on the server and access files that are stored from a different machine. Okay? All examples of resource sharing. Because there's a network and you can communicate over the network, resources on this other set of processors or other machines become available to you. Okay? And you are able to share those resources. Okay, that's a big advantage, especially in scenarios where resources are expensive or scarce. Okay? Network printers being another example. Okay, if you don't have a printer attached to every machine, you share a printer. You know, and you can communicate and send print job to that printer over a network. Okay, so that's basically another example. Okay, that's one big advantage. Okay? Another advantage is computational speed up. Okay? If you have n processors, as is shown in this picture, that are coordinating with one another, that are interacting with one another, you can harness the resources of those n processors. Your application, the distributed application that runs on these processors, basically has access to the computational resources of n different processors. Okay, so you can get n times the throughput in principle. Okay. So if you have a distributed system where you are just running jobs, okay, on these n processors, you get n times the speed up. Okay, if you run things like SETI at home and things like this, right? So those kinds of systems harness computational power of tens of thousands of machines on the internet. Okay, so you can run very large computational jobs by parallelizing them and sending small pieces of that jobs to lots of different machines. Okay, this computational speed up, for this, the problem that you are trying to address must be decomposable into sub-problems, and you assign each sub-problem to a processor. Okay? Now what you do need is the ability to do coordination and communication. Okay? These processors must be able to coordinate the execution of these jobs and communicate with one another. You might have to do synchronization across processors and things like that. Just all the things that you did when you had multi-threaded programs. Okay? Now you have to do when you have multi-process systems that are actually running on different machines. Okay? So this increases the complexity of the system, but the advantage is if you do that well, you can actually get n times your computational power. Okay? Yet another advantage is reliability. Okay? Because you have more than one machines typically in your distributed system, the failure of any one machine need not take down your entire application. The application can continue to function by moving that functionality to other machines that are still up. Okay? It's a very important thing to keep in mind. Okay? Every distributed system actually can get better reliability if you have good design. Okay? It is not necessary that you will get reliability. If you have a single point of failure in your system and that machine goes down, the whole system comes down. Yeah, but if you design the system well, that need not be the case. There are lots of examples, right? Google is a good example. Okay, it runs on maybe the search engine runs on tens or hundreds of thousands of machines. At any given point in time, a significant fraction of those machines in the order of hundreds or thousands may be down for maintenance or because of hardware faults. Okay, but you can still access the search engine. Okay, it doesn't mean that the search engine has just gone down. An example of a well-designed distributed system. Okay? And there are many examples of systems that are not well-designed. Okay? There were all these Twitter outages recently. If you follow Twitter, you know about them. Right? So those are distributed systems where there are single points of failure. Okay? Something went down and the whole system went down. Okay? And it became unavailable to all of its users. Okay? So if you have to design a system well to do this, if you do that, then you basically don't have to deal with one single failure taking down your entire system. Okay? So you want to avoid single points of failure, okay, by replicating data, replicating code, and having one machine take over the task that some other machine was doing. Okay? The last advantage is ability to communicate. Okay, here we are talking about humans or processes communicating. Okay? So you can send email, for example. You can do chats, you can do email, you can go to social networking sites, you can go to your bank, do transactions online, you can buy an air ticket online. Lots of these things happen because you have distributed systems. Okay, so you can have machines the network allows people to communicate, okay, and achieve, do useful things. Okay. So, that's basically all the advantages. So modern environments, so summary is modern environments are distributed in some shape or form. So the operating system that's running on these machines needs to support these features. Okay, so then the last question is, what is the component inside the operating system that enables all of this? Okay, that's the network subsystem that we are going to talk about. Okay, we've done the I/O subsystem, memory subsystem, processing, CPU scheduling and whatnot. The last component is the network subsystem part of the kernel. Okay? So that's the part we are going to start looking at. Okay, now there are several issues you have to think of when you design a distributed system. Okay, how is the communication going to take place? What kind of network are you going to use? Is this a wireless application? Is it a wired application? Does it work over Wi-Fi? Okay. All of those things you need to deal with. There's this important issue of transparency, which I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. That basically transparency says how well can the application hide the fact that it's running on multiple machines from you. Okay? So think of Google as an example. Okay, whenever you type a search query, okay, Google hides from you where the search query executes, where the results are coming from. It doesn't matter from a user perspective. All you care about are the results of your search query. Okay? They have 10,000 machines in the background. Okay? They don't tell you which machine actually executed your care query. Okay? Think of a different design. If you wanted to do a search query, if Google said, go to machine 13,510 and send your query there. Okay? And every time you go to the machine, it assigns you a different machine. That's an example of not a transparent system, because it is actually exporting to the user the fact that it runs on multiple machines. It makes the user make multiple decisions rather than hiding it from the user and dealing with these problems internally in the system. Okay? So whenever you design a distributed system, you have a choice. Okay, how transparent do you make the system to the user? How do you hide all the internal details of how the system operates and let the user do their task? Okay, not worry about all the internals. Okay? Well-designed systems tend to be transparent, okay, from many perspectives. Okay? So that's basically a thing to keep in mind. We'll not deal with this issue here, but it's an important issue. Security is another issue. Okay? Because your machines are now on a network, okay, security becomes a very important issue, because your machines can be accessed from anywhere. That also means that they are vulnerable to attacks from anywhere. From hackers, malicious users, worms, viruses, all of these problems crop. So whenever you have distributed systems or distributed applications, security of your application is very important. So to secure the communication, you have to secure the machines. Okay? All of these issues were non-issues when you had a single machine that was not connected to a network. If you're not connected, that by definition you don't communicate with anything else, nobody can get into your machine. Physically your machine may get stolen, but if it's sitting on a network, you're not going to, or if it's not sitting on a network, it's not going to get attacked. So security is another important issue which we will actually ignore in this discussion on distributed system. Okay. And then there's reliability. We already mentioned that if you don't have single points of failure, you can deal with machine going down, application continues to run. Okay. In centralized applications, this is not the case. Okay. If the machine that's running your Spire app goes down, you cannot register for courses. Okay. End of story. There's nothing you can do about it. Okay. On the other hand, if it's replicated on multiple machines, if one machine goes down, you can still go to or transparently be redirected to other machines and the system continues to work. Okay, so if you design your systems well, then you get better reliability. If you have centralized applications, you have single points of failure. Okay, performance and scalability we talked about. As you add more machines, your system performance continues to increase. Yeah, if you have 100 machines, you can harness the power of 100 machines to run your app. If you have 500 machines, can scale to the power of having 500 machines. Okay. So you get performance and scalability. Okay. Last but not least, there is this issue of programming model. Okay. How do you write distributed application? What programming methodologies language do you use? What tools do you use to do it? Okay. At a very basic level, you can actually use C, C++, Java, and all the languages that you know about to write distributed application. We'll see how to do that starting next time. Okay? But there are higher level tools that have been designed to do all of this. There are web programming toolkits that make it very easy to write a distributed web application. Okay, rather than writing thousands of lines of code, you write hundreds of lines of code. Okay, lot of the internal details of how to do the communication, all that is hidden from the programmer. Okay? So this is very important. Okay, as you write large scalable distributed application, the programming methodology you use and the tools you use actually have a lot to do with how much time you are going to spend writing your code. Right? The better tools will actually reduce the amount of code you end up writing. We will come back to that when we do RPCs and RMIs next time. Okay. So now I'm going to do a quick run through networks and give you some background before we start talking about distributed system, because this is essential knowledge. This is stuff that is dealt with in 453. Okay. It's just like a 5-slide or 6-slide refresher on what a network is. Okay. So networks by definition are essentially a communication medium. Okay. They allow machines to communicate with one another. Okay. Most of you have dealt with network because most of your machines have a network card. It could be a Wi-Fi card, Ethernet card, doesn't matter. Okay, but you have a network card on your machine. You can connect that card to a network and then you can communicate. Okay. There are different types of networks as it turns out. Okay, typically what the network that your machine connects to tends to be a local area network, also called a LAN. Okay. LANs are used to connect machines typically within a single building or a single floor, maybe a single campus, a small set of buildings. Okay. Ethernet 802.11 are examples of local area networks. Okay, that's the home-based network as well. Okay. And if you have wired medium, you have twisted pair or coax cables. If you have wireless medium, then you are using some wireless protocol for that communication. Okay. Typical speeds you see here range from tens of megabits per second to gigabits per second. Okay. Wi-Fi, 50 megabits, maybe 100 megabits per second. You have gigi, that's a gigabit per second. You have 10 gigi, it's 10 gigabits per second. Okay, depending on what interface you use, you get a variety of these speeds. Okay, you might have a wireless broadband card, you might get maybe up to a megabit, if you're lucky. Okay, that's LAN. So on the other hand, what you have is a wide area network that connects machines or nodes across larger distances. Okay, this could be across cities, across states, across countries, okay, and on a global scale, across continents. Okay. Typically, these are much longer links. Okay, they may be undersea links, okay, that connect two continents. They could be cable that you have laid actually connect multiple states or organizations that are spread out. Okay. They're all called WANs or wide area network. They tend to be slower than LANs. Okay. The speeds are nowhere as close. Okay. And they also tend to be less reliable, because as the distance increases, the reliability of the medium goes down. There are more errors when you send bits over longer links. Okay. Typical media can be telephone lines. This is how you had modem and dial-ups. That was examples of how machines used to communicate. Okay. You can have microwave links, you can have satellite channels, you can have fiber that's been laid underground. Okay. And the speeds here go from 1.5 megabits per second to 45 megabits per second to maybe 192 or 600 megabits per second. Okay. They're still in the tens or hundreds of megabits per second. LANs are now in tens of gigabits per second. Okay, they're much higher speed. Okay. So WANs tend to be slower than LANs. WANs connect machines across larger distances than LANs. Okay, that's the important thing to keep in mind. Is that clear? Any questions on this? The internet is an example of a global scale WAN. Okay, it's really a network of networks. It connects multiple WANs together. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Okay. So now there is a question of, regardless of whether you have a LAN or a WAN, what is the structure you are going to use to connect nodes? Okay, so there are many, and this is referred to as the topology of the network. There are many different topologies possible. Okay. First, we are going to talk about point-to-point topologies as opposed to shared network topologies. Okay. Even in the point-to-point topologies, there are different architectures. Okay. So this picture shows you what is called a fully connected network topology. Okay. Here every node is directly connected to every other node, a node being a machine. Okay. So circles are nodes and edges here are links. So every node is directly connected to every other node using a direct link. Okay. That means there is actually a physical wire that is going from every machine to every other machine. An actual wire. Okay. So what this means is every node or every machine can talk to every other machine using a single hop. Okay, your message that you are sending basically just traverses one link or one hop to get to any destination, because you have a fully connected topology. Okay. So messages will be very fast because they only go one hop to go to any other destination. Okay. Failure of any one node does not impact communication. You can still communicate with other nodes. Okay. So advantages are single hop messages, failures can be dealt with easily. The disadvantage is this is very expensive. Okay, you need order n square wires to connect to one another. Okay. So in the LAN this may be okay, but in a WAN it's definitely not okay. You're not going to have undersea cables going from every country to every other country. Okay, or for every machine to every other machine. That just doesn't work. Okay. Now the interesting thing is in a wireless network, this is eminently possible. Right? So if you basically have what's called an ad hoc Wi-Fi network, basically a group of laptops that can send a direct message to every other laptop because that laptop happens to be in range. Okay? The communication may have interference because machines may try to talk to one another at the same time and interfere on the wireless channel. Okay? But this is much easier to achieve because there's no cabling cost. Okay? You're just sending a message that goes over the wire and hits the other machine. Okay. So in a wireless network, you can still have communication that uses this topology. A machine can send a direct message over the wireless medium to another machine. Okay. Does not have to be the case, but it's possible to design networks to do that. Okay. But in the wired case, this is the most expensive topology that you can think of. Okay. So to reduce the cost, you don't have fully connected topologies. You typically have partially connected topology. Okay, so this basically says it's too expensive to have wire going from every machine to every other machine. So we'll only have some links, but not all. But there will be some way for any machine to still talk to some other machine via some intermediate nodes. Okay, because there is no direct connection anymore, you cannot directly send a message. You might have to relay that message through other machines. Okay, so this is an example of a partially connected topology. So if this node here wants to send a message there, you will have to actually route this message to those other two intermediate nodes and find a path through the network. Okay. So which is less expensive because there are fewer connections, okay, fewer links, less tolerant to failures. Okay, you can have network partitions. So if this link goes down, for instance, you have two partitions. Okay, machines within each partition can talk to one another, but no messages can go across partition because there's a single link, okay, that connects those two partitions, and that link has gone down. Okay, so you basically, if you have partially connected topology, network partitions are possible. Failure of a link can actually cause some machines to become inaccessible from the other partition. Okay. The second thing is sending a message now requires multiple hops. So you have to find a path from the source machine to the destination machine, and then you have to send the message through a set of intermediate nodes. Okay. This is referred to as routing. Okay. You are routing a message from one machine to another. Okay. This is how all modern networks work. When you send a message from your machine using, let's say, TCP/IP, that message is actually routed by intermediate nodes, which are called routers, to the destination. Okay. So typically WANs use this structure. Okay. You will have end hosts, and then some of those nodes are actually routers, which is basically all they do is relay messages. They don't actually do any actual communication. Okay. They are just there to forward the message to the next hop. Here is yet another topology. Okay, it's a tree structure. Okay, so here your network is hierarchical. Okay, so you have a root node, and then there may be some child nodes to for that root. There may be some other children and so on. So you get a tree-like structure. Okay, so for any node, so this is also partially connected, but there's a partially connected topology with a certain structure which has a hierarchy imposed on it. Okay, so here, for a message to go from node A to node B, you have to send the message up the tree until you hit your common ancestor, and then it starts traversing down the tree. Okay, so depends on which node. So if this node wants to talk to that node, you send it one node to your parent, that's your common ancestor, and then it comes back down. If this node wants to talk to that node, it actually goes all the way to the root and starts coming down. Okay, that's how messages get routed through this hierarchy. Okay. Typically, organizations and corporate networks use this topology, okay, because it matches the view of that organization. Okay. Universities also have this topology. Okay. If you think of a university, there is basically a gateway node, let's say for UMass. Okay. There are nodes for each department. Okay. There's CS, there's engineering and whatnot. And then within here, there are machines. Right, so if you want to send out a message, you basically send it to your departmental router. Your departmental router may actually send that out to the main router, and then it may go to some other router for other department and go there. So organizations tend to like this structure because your network topology matches the organizational structure. Okay, it doesn't have to be the case, but if you match, then that makes the management of that network easier. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So this is clearly not tolerant of a failure. If any link goes down, some subtree is going to get disconnected. If this link goes down, right, the CS network then becomes disconnected from the rest of the campus. Okay, these your machines within your department can talk to one another, but you cannot actually send any messages out. Okay, this happens a lots of times. So if all your email gets queued up here, mail doesn't go out, mail is not coming in. Okay, so when the network link is restored, then messages can start going back and forth. Okay. So the last point-to-point topology is called a star topology. Okay, so we looked at, actually it's not the last, there are two or three more, but they actually start having different structures. So in this case, what happens is all nodes connect to a single central node. Okay. And then messages are routed through that single node to any other destination. So every message, basically, so the central site is typically dedicated for network traffic. Each message takes only two hops. Okay, you send a message to the central node, and the central node sends that back. Okay, and now basically, if your central node fails, central node is a point of failure. If that node fails, your entire network goes down. Okay, but if any of the outer nodes fail, only that node goes down. The rest of the network continues to function. This is inexpensive and it's sometimes used for LAN. Okay, if you have a home Wi-Fi router, okay, that's the topology your Wi-Fi network has. Okay, that node in the middle is actually the Wi-Fi router. All of your Wi-Fi nodes, your laptops or whatever other devices you have, always send your message to the router, and this router can send it back, can also send it out to the internet. Okay, but so it's a star topology that you have for most wireless networks. Okay, you have a wired Ethernet that can also use a star topology. If you have a switch and all the machines connect into a switch, the switch is the central node. Okay, and then there are ring topologies. Okay, so this is an interesting topology where machines are arranged in the form of a ring. Okay, so far if you want machine I to talk to machine J, you send the message along the ring, either in the clockwise or the anti-clockwise direction. It keeps hopping until it reaches its destination. Okay. So given n nodes, you may have up to n minus 1 hops, okay, for your message to reach the destination. Okay, so if this node wants to talk to this node and it just happens to send the message in the wrong direction, if it sends it this way, it's going to circulate through the ring until it hits it. If it sent it directly, there's only one hop, but you can actually have up to n minus 1 hops. Okay? So this is inexpensive because there are fewer links, but any failure of a node partitions the network. The ring goes away if one machine goes down. Okay? Any questions on this? So there are two types of rings, unidirectional and bidirectional. Unidirectional says you can always send messages either clockwise or anti-clockwise. Bidirectional says you can pick which direction to send the message in. Okay, pick the shorter of the two paths and send the message that way. Okay, so in bidirectional ring, you can have at most n over 2 hops for your message. Okay, because you pick the shorter one, and if you are diametrically opposite, you will have n over 2 hops. Okay, any questions on this? Where do you see this kind of topology? Okay, so token ring. So token ring is an example of an early LAN technology that came out of IBM. Okay, token ring and Ethernet were two competing technologies. Ethernet came out of Xerox PARC and then 3COM and companies like that used to sell Ethernet gear, and then IBM was a big proponent of token ring. It was a LAN topology. So back in the 80s, when you bought a machine, you have to specify, do you want an Ethernet card or do you want a token ring card, depending on what type of network you connected to. If your organization had a token ring network, you have to buy a PC with a token ring card. Okay? And then it would basically sit as one of the machines in the ring. All machines in your department would basically be on a ring. Okay? You basically plug into the ring and then you keep sending messages. Okay? If you are on the Ethernet, which we'll see, then you have a different topology. So now that technology is no longer there. I mean, you don't hear of token ring anymore. It essentially, Ethernet won the battle, okay, and token ring lost, and nobody uses token ring anymore. Okay. So that's at the LAN level. Okay, but in modern applications, there are still examples of this topology. So if you look at some modern peer-to-peer applications, okay, some of them actually use a ring structure. It's a logical ring, not a physical ring. All the nodes, all the peers that are participating in the network basically become a node in a large logical ring. Okay, and then that's how they communicate. Okay, not all peer-to-peer networks are rings. Like you think, take things like Nutella and so on, they don't use rings. Okay, but there are many that actually use a ring topology. Okay, there are things like Cord and CAN and so on that use that topology. Okay, so here we have unidirectional link, bidirectional link. Here you have a doubly linked list, ring, okay, like a doubly linked list. So what happens in a doubly linked ring is you don't just have a link to your neighbor, you have a link to your neighbor's neighbor as well. Okay, so you can actually go this way. So what this does is if your neighbor goes down, the ring does not get partitioned, because you can still communicate with the rest of the ring by just hopping over your neighbor. Okay, so you have two links going, one to your neighbor and one to your neighbor's neighbor. And what this does is if you intelligently route, you can go from any node to any other node in n over 2 hops. Okay, because it allows you to skip nodes. So if this node wants to send a message there, you don't have to go through the actual thing. You can just keep skipping and reach the destination in fewer hops. Okay, so it allows you to tolerate failures. It also allows you to route messages with fewer hops. So last one for the topologies is bus-based topology. Okay, this is what the first of these two is what Ethernet looks like. Okay, so here we have a shared medium. Okay, these are not direct links, but you have a bus which is essentially a shared network. Okay, any machine can send a message on the bus. Okay, and it basically gets to the other nodes in one hop. Now the disadvantage is if multiple machines try to send messages at the same time, the messages are going to interfere with one another. So like in any other bus based medium, there can be contention. If multiple machines want to send messages, there will be contention. Those messages will collide with one another and your message will get destroyed. So you will have to retry. Right? So basically the advantage is it's a shared medium. So you are basically a one hop to any other node, but then because it's a shared medium, you can have contention. Okay? In point-to-point links, if you are the only one sending the message, okay, there's no one else sharing that link with you, other than the node at the other end. Okay, but if it's a duplex ring, you can each send messages in both directions concurrently. Okay? So this is how Ethernet, early Ethernet looks like. Okay? It was a shared medium. Every message is broadcast to every other node. This is a broadcast-based medium. You put out a message, it reaches all the nodes. The nodes do the filtering. Is the message meant for me? If so, you accept. Otherwise, then your Ethernet card discards that message. Okay? So that's Ethernet LAN. Okay, ring is basically also a shared medium, but you are basically a shared circular link. Okay, so there's this circular link is a shared medium, and you are tapping into the ring. So you can put out a message on this ring. Okay, it basically just gets broadcast to all of the nodes on that link. Okay. Same trade-off as a linear bus. Okay. Is that clear? So this is shared Ethernet. Modern Ethernets are actually not necessarily bus-based medium. Okay. This is just an aside. Modern Ethernets are switched. It means if you put out a message on the network, it doesn't get broadcast to all of the nodes. Okay. The switch intelligently only sends it to the node that it was meant for, okay, rather than broadcasting it. Okay, because this doesn't scale. If you can think, if you think about it, if you have 700 nodes on your network, if every message that every machine was sending actually gets broadcast to every other message, there's a lot of wasted messages that machines are receiving on this shared medium that are not meant for them. Okay. So to prevent this, and then you cannot scale. At some point, there will be so much cross-chatter on your network that no useful message will get through. The network will get congested. Okay, to avoid this problem, you can have switched Ethernet. So if you look at gigabit Ethernet, they are all switched, they are not shared. So your old 10 megabits or 100 megabit switch, okay, that's actually a shared medium. Okay. Wi-Fi by definition is shared, because there's no way to actually carve out a channel on the air. Okay, so if you're putting out a message, and some other machine is also trying to send at the same time, your message will collide in the air. The only way to avoid this is to have separate networks on separate channels. That is the only way to avoid this problem. Otherwise, the medium is shared, the spectrum, the 2 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz, whichever Wi-Fi you have, it's a shared medium. If any other node transmits, it will collide with your message and then you have to retry. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so one last thing that I'm going to talk about, and then a few more slides on the exam. Okay. So the last point here is how actually applications are constructed in a network, how they talk to one another. So typically any data that you want to send is sent as a network packet. Okay, so you take the data, you chop it up into smaller chunks. A chunk is referred to as a packet, and the packet is independently sent over the network. The network will route the packet until it arrives at the other end, and then packets are reassembled to construct the original message. Okay? So chop the data, any message which is data you want to send, chop it up into packets, send each packet over the network, all packets arrive at the other end, you reassemble the message and the application gets it. Okay. So basically there are computers at the each intermediate node that basically are called routers that control how packets flow through the network. Okay. And so the analogy basically is that you have shared nodes and there are shared links. Okay. So links may be shared, nodes may be shared, and I'll show you an example of how this actually works. Okay. So what is shown in this picture are three machines, okay, A, B and C. Okay. B is an intermediate machine, it's actually a router. In this case, A and B are actual end hosts. Okay. This picture actually shows you the network subsystem that runs within the OS on these two machines. Okay. This is called a network stack. In this case, you have basically several layers within the network stack. I'll talk about them in just a moment. And there's some network component that's running on the router. Okay. At the very top, you have applications. Okay. Applications are the ones that communicate. Okay. This could be a web browser, that could be a web server, just as an example. Okay. When a web browser wants to send an HTTP message to the web server, it will actually construct a message and then hand it to the layer below it. Okay. That's the presentation layer. And the presentation layer will do some processing and hand the data to the layer below it, to the session layer, and it goes down these layers. This is called a network stack, and then the last layer, which is a physical layer, puts it out on the wire, and then it appears at this node. This node does some processing, it figures out where should the packet be sent, says let's send it to C, so it forwards the packet to C, and then the packet actually traverses up the protocol stack to the physical data link network transport layer and is handed over to the application. Okay. So in any network protocol stack, the applications actually send the packet down the protocol stack. It does, there's some processing done at each of these layers, and then you put it out on the wire to the next node forwards it to the next node. There may be multiple hops before it reaches the destination, and then it goes up the protocol stack. Okay. Now I'll talk a little bit about this protocol stack, but the easiest example of the protocol stack is the TCP/IP stack. This is what is used in the internet for communication. There are lots of different protocol stacks out there. Okay. The most common one that is typically used is the TCP/IP stack, where in the TCP/IP stack, what runs at the network level is called IP. What runs at the transport level is called TCP. So this is why you get the name TCP/IP stack. Typically, the TCP/IP stack doesn't have these two layers. Now, the application here that's running on TCP, which is running on IP, and then you have the data link layer. This is your Ethernet, okay, and Ethernet MAC control, and then the physical wire itself. Okay. So because we are short on time, I'm going to come back to this next time, okay, and we and then discuss this in a little more detail. Okay, so before, so let me, 5 minutes, I just want to give a little bit of a overview of what you should do for the exam. Okay, so let me just spend a few minutes there. Yes, first of all, the material on the exam, deadlocks and memory management. Okay, I/O files system, I/O, and the material on distributed system is not on exam 2. Okay, it is just going to be deadlocks, which is where we left off for exam 1, and then all of the stuff on memory management. Okay, so I'm going to quickly review deadlock. Okay, so topics you need to understand. Okay, we've reviewed 4 conditions, necessary conditions for a deadlock to occur. What are those conditions? Why are they not sufficient? You have to understand the difference between detecting deadlocks and preventing deadlocks. Okay, in one case you detect deadlocks after they have happened. In another case you put constraints on the system so deadlocks can never occur. Okay. Then if you do deadlock detection, then what can you do to break the deadlock? Okay. You can take back locks, you can do preemption of locks, you can kill processes and whatnot. Okay. So we looked at that, that's what you need to understand. Then there was this concept of a safe state. When we did Banker's algorithm, we said a safe state is one in which all processes can complete without there being a deadlock. Okay. What is a safe state? And then corollary is what is an unsafe state? And hence a deadlock state. Okay, so you need to understand this. You need to understand Banker's algorithm. Okay, that we did several exercises in class. It was a long time back. So go back and review all of that code. Okay. As far as what you should be able to do, given some code, you need to be able to figure out, will that cause a deadlock? Will that not cause a deadlock? If you say here's a Banker's algorithm, need to analyze it and say, is this a safe state, not a safe state, and so on. Okay? We need to do hold and wait analysis, saying if there is some processes that are holding some resources, waiting on some other resources, does that result in a cycle? Will that result in a deadlock? So all of these exercises that we have done in class. Okay? So this is banker's algorithm. Given a set of resources allocated to a process, the maximum requirement available resources, determine if this is a safe state. This was exactly what banker's algorithm did. Okay? Then the flip side of it is if you are given code that can result in a deadlock, what might you do to avoid that deadlock? How would you make some small changes to the code to remove that deadlock? Okay, this might require you to change the order in which locks or semaphores are acquired, okay, and get rid of the deadlock in your code. Okay, so this was material we did way back when we did lectures 13 and 14. Okay, so go back, review it. Okay, memory management, the whole discussion on memory management is part of the test. So you need to understand what is virtual memory, how do we use it. Okay. All the contiguous, all the memory allocation strategies, starting from contiguous allocation, okay, first fit and best fit that you know, paging, segmentation and page segmentation. Okay. Let me again emphasize that several people just disappeared from class when we talked about paging and segmentation. Okay. So if you want the TA to review this material, I can ask him to do that, okay, tomorrow. Okay, so lots of small details here, address translation. Okay, we looked at how do you take logical addresses, convert to physical addresses, the hardware that you need to do that, base registers, segment registers, page tables, how do you deal with fragmentation, how do you grow processes, okay, which scheme allows you to grow processes, which scheme makes it harder, how do you share memory, you can share pages, you can share segments, how is that done, okay, what happens when you move a process from one location to another, how much memory copying do you have to do, what memory protection schemes are available to make sure that pages are read-only, read-write, and so on. Okay? And all the steps to do a context switch. Okay, when you do a context switch, all the steps that you need to occur when page faults occur. Okay, so things you should be able to do, given a request for memory, see if you can satisfy it using contiguous allocation, will there be fragmentation, given a virtual address and necessary tables, do the translation to physical addresses. Okay, the last thing is paging. Okay, paging and segmentation. So what is paging, what's the page frame, how are the data structures stored, you need to remember that concept of a TLB, it's a cache for the page table. Okay, and demand paging, page faults, all of those issues that we discussed, how to compute the memory access, effective memory access time, given certain probabilities for TLB hits and TLB misses. Okay, we did a whole bunch of page replacement algorithms. This is where you can expect some questions, like here is a sequence of page accesses, how many page faults can occur if you have 3 frames or 5 frames, things like that. Okay, we did 7 of those exercises here. Okay, so that's basically this, given a page reference string and fixed number of page frames, determine this. Okay, so file systems are not part of the thing. So go back, review this material. I'm going to have the TA do a little bit more detailed review tomorrow. Okay, Thursday is a guest lecture, remember that. So tomorrow is a good time to come with questions. Okay, we'll have extra office hours next week. Okay, if you have more questions. And then Tuesday is when the test is. Okay, I will send out a sample exam shortly, okay, because I need to go dig one up, but I'll send that out so you can get a feel for this material. Okay, like last time, start with the lecture notes. Don't start with the textbook and start reading 300 pages. Okay, start with the lecture notes, slides and the lecture notes, and then go review material from the book. Okay, so let's stop here.